So, yes, our last class, we introduced this concept of a hypersurface, where it could basically take our four-dimensional space-time manifold and select, for example, a surface of constant time, some choice of time, called hypersurface. And then we started defining geometric quantities, intrinsic and extrinsic, to that hypersurface. And so the obvious generalization to that is what's called a foliation. Where we take our whole space-time manifold and rewrite it as a set of hypersurfaces, which we can parameterize by some function, which the obvious label is to think of it as time. And so then each, you can call them slices or leaves. You can think of that as some level surface of some function, which I'll call t hat, which just gives a level set of all the points in your manifold that are, so this is really a set of level sets, one for each t. So we're going to require t hat to be smooth, and for its gradient to not be zero anywhere. If it's zero somewhere, then if we have one slice sigma t and some other slice sigma t prime, then they could intersect even if t and t prime are different. So that's why I require this.
Sorry, I didn't quite get that. You just have to why we're setting that equal to lambda to be zero.
Because if it's zero at some point, that basically means you're not changing. Basically, you can have the same point on one hypersurface and the next hypersurface.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So we want to sort of each point to be on a at a unique time, distinct point space time. All right, yeah. So a space time that emits such a foliation, we call globally hyperbolic. And then, of course, the reason we're introducing all this terminology is because we want to, in sort of the next couple classes, go to thinking of Einstein equations as some sort of constraint equations for initial data at t equals zero hypersurfaces and evolution equations that take us from one hypersurface to the next. So let me briefly introduce some terminology associated with this space-time decomposition. So you recall that we introduced this unit normal to our slices of constant time. So it's in the direction of the gradient of t. And again, I'm just going to drop the difference between t hat and t here. And then it's a unit normal future pointing. So in components, again, choosing coordinates that are adapted to this choice of time. It'll just have a time component when we have it right with lower indices. And so the time component here, I'm going to minus that rather, is usually referred to as the elapse. So sometimes you also see people use n instead of alpha for the lapse, but here we use alpha. And if we want to work that out in terms of metric components, if we use this condition here, we get that. So that means this lapse is just that in terms of the inverse metric, the TT component. So we can raise the unit normal, and then we get something like this, where here I'm introducing a new quantity, which is called the shift vector. And again, sometimes people use ni for that, but here we'll use beta. And you know, again, we can explicitly work that out in terms of the metric components. So we just got that by raising the metric. So we have this relation, which means that the shift should just be given by that. Okay, and so we can, you know, as we kind of alluded to previously, we can think of NA as the velocity of some fiducial observer, right? Because it's, you know, future pointing, time-like unit vector. And so in that sense, we can sort of think of the lapse as, you know, dt or d tau dt, where that would be the sort of proper time of that observer. And then minus the shift is sort of the coordinate velocity of that observer. All right. So this unit normal is closely related to the what's called the normal evolution operator. And I'll call that MA, and it's proportional to the unit normal just times the lapse. And you know, now this has the property that this is equal to 1. You can just check from that definition there, follows immediately. And that means that if we consider the time at some space-time point P, and we're interested in how what the time will be at some nearby point, at some future, some small time later, delta t, then that's given by basically by this evolution operator. So sort of in terms of pictures, you can think of, we have one hypersurface t, sigma t, another hypersurface, sigma t plus delta t. We have some point p, and then this evolution operator times delta t will take us to this point here.
But I didn't get like why we're not using na as evolution operator while we are rescaling it. Like why having that equal to 1 would help us having evolution operator. Why can't just like use
n? Yeah, I mean, we just have an extra factor of alpha here. I mean, they point in the same direction, right? But it's just the normalization. Because basically, this is sort of telling us how our time coordinate is changing from one to the next.
Yes. And why the operator shouldn't be like normal? Like, what, why are we not using the fact that n, a and a is equal to minus 1?
So I mean, with that, you can kind of think of it as an observer, but with this normalization, it sort of tells you where you'll be after a delta t. I mean, if you put n here, you would just get some extra factor of the lapse here, right? So that's all.
How can I get, if I said instead of m I use n, why I will get an extra alpha with it? I can't see this.
Just because, so you get a, so like basically from this property, this follows, right? And so if, so for this, you have an extra lapse here, right? So yeah, it's basically just saying your time can change slightly because, and so if you just used n here, you'd be at a slightly, you wouldn't be at delta t, be, yeah.
Can I ask a question online?
So last class I mentioned how we can sort of think of the extrinsic curvature as determining the evolution of the spatial metric. So let's return to that point here. And we're going to calculate the lead derivative of the spatial metric with respect to n. Right, so last class I wrote down this expression, which we're gonna, I think, use several times in class. Let me call that double star. Relating the extrinsic curvature to this, the covariate derivative of the unit normal. And then call that the acceleration. So if we use this fact, and also you would call that we can write gamma AB in terms of GAB plus NA NB, right? So by metric compatibility, that means this will just equal this. So if we make those two substitutions and sort of like this and this and crunch through that, then we arrive at the following. Or if we want to rewrite in terms of MA, we get that because sort of all the extra terms due to this lapse will sort of just involve gamma times and then go to zero. But you know, this basically tells you that the, you know, this is essentially an evolution operator for gamma AB, and it's basically just given by the extrinsic curvature. So this is purely kinematical. We haven't used the Einstein equations at all, but this tells us how the, basically the extrinsic curvature tells us how the you know, intrinsic metric will evolve from one time slice to the next.
I'm confused. What is this KAC over there?
This is the extrinsic curvature.
Okay, that'll be
last session.
Okay, and then what we're doing is that we just want to try to see the evolution of the intrinsic metric, like gamma, by taking the lead derivative out of it, right? And then, And the second line over there come from the definition of gamma AB, which was like GAB plus NAB, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So there'd be one extra term, but then it goes to zero because of the metric compatibility. Yep.
Can I ask a question on Dyne? Do you hear me? Hello.
Yeah, so the goal for the rest of the class is going to be to decompose the Einstein equations into this 3 plus 1 form. So before we actually get to the physics part of plugging in the Einstein equations, we're basically going to have to take the Riemann tensor and decompose it into all its parts, you know, project it with the sort of project into components that are on the spatial slices or orthogonal to spatial slices. So it's going to get a little bit messy. I'm not going to go through all the algebra, but if you sort of want to see all the nitty-gritty details of the calculation, I would invite you to take a look at the Gourgagnon 3 plus 1 decomposition notes that I put the archive number on last time. It's also on the course sheet.
Can you just, before that, say briefly, when can we say that the manifold cannot admit foliation? Like, what is the situation that we cannot define?
Yeah, I didn't tell you that. All I'm saying really is that if it does emit this, we call it globally hyperbolic. Not all spacetimes will do that, but I mean, sort of the ones that don't, you know, would be somewhat pathological.
What are the by admitting foliation, we just mean that we can define some operator T that can give us like constant times T on some hypersurfaces.
Yeah, so we're defining globally hyperbolic as, yeah, we can take our whole manifold, we can cover it with these hypersurfaces that are the level sets of this T hat, and that T hat is smooth and that its gradient doesn't disappear anywhere.
So your second term in your leader is not right, the indices should be gamma C, B, nabla A, and C.
One of the C's should be A.
Nabla A.
Oh. Yes.
What?
Right. No. That's
it's BC number A, I think.
Yeah. Okay. All right, that one looks good. Okay, thank you. Yeah.
Can I ask a question online? Do you hear me?
All right.
Sorry. I think they're not hearing me yet.
Space-like for this construction.
So sorry, what's that?
Do we necessarily need sigmas to be space-like for this construction? Because we assume them to be space-like. But we can also fillet the manifold with time-like surfaces or like other surfaces.
Yeah, so in general, I mean, you can define hypersurfaces that are null or time-like and do a foliation. But here, yeah, I mean, we're sort of keeping in mind that they're space-like. So we can sort of think of evolution and so forth and think of having constraints on our space-like surfaces and then evolution operators to take us to the next one. But yeah, in general, the sort of technology can be applied to those cases as well. And most of the formulas will look the same.
You know that like the union of all of the foliations over a manifold gives us the manifold itself. So like if we when evolution of the induced metric is given by the extrinsic curvature of the original manifold, it means that like extrinsic curvature is somehow also because we can get the evolution of the induced metric from there. So it means that like at the end, by that we can know the extrinsic curvature of the hypersurface as well. Is it indicating that?
Yeah, but
now we'll see. So like,
I don't think so.
Like, if you have the whole space time, yeah, you can compute all these quantities. I mean, where we're sort of going is, if you just start with one hypersurface, and you specify the, extrinsic and intrinsic curvature, then just kinematics will tell you how to get the spatial metric at the next time slice, but but then we need physics to tell us how what to get the extrinsic curvature at the next time slice. So that, yep.
Can I ask a question here? Do you hear me?
Yep.
Oh, finally. Thank you. Sorry. So it's been a while that I have a question, but my voice was not coming through.
Yeah, you have to speak up.
Okay, is it better now?
Go ahead.
So I just wanted to ask about the time evolution operator that you define. So usually I've seen that it has a shift component. And I was just wondering why you didn't consider shift here. It's just, I mean, why it's in the same direction of t, and only we have the lapse function, I mean, the lapse coefficient, but no shifts.
No, it'll have a shift component when you write it with upstairs indices, right? Because it's in the same direction as na, right? So it's literally na times alpha.
Oh, it was the lower index. Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Anything else? All right, so yeah, basically, what we want to do is decompose the Riemann tensor. You'll recall from last time that sort of by definition, the spatial Riemann tensor, just in the same way that the four-dimensional one is defined, is basically given by the difference when you switch the indices of the covariant derivatives, in this case, the spatial covariant ones. And this holds for any one-form UC. So we can rewrite this right-hand side using the relationship between these three-dimensional covariant derivatives and the four-dimensional ones just using the projection operators. So we're going to use that, and then again we're going to use this definition of the spatial metric in terms of the space-time metric and NA and B, and again we're going to use that double star relationship there to basically change covariant derivatives of the unit normal into extrinsic curvature. So, when I rewrite the side using this and this, you know, again, metric compatibility means derivative of that will be zero. So we'll get a bunch of derivatives of N A and B, which will simplify using that double star equation. So sort of when the dust clears, we get something like this. And so then if we contract A with C, we get the following.
Sorry, why do you have two B these in the lower indices of gamma the first term? I have gamma at the end.
Yep, that's not right. This A, B, H. It's just a messy H. Yeah. Any other mistakes? All right. Yeah, so if we contract C and A, then we're going to get, this is Annie's K for the trace of the extrinsic curvature. And then this equals all right, and we're going to call this equation diamond because we're going to need that one later. And then if we apply gamma dB to this to get the three-dimensional Ricci scalar, then we get this. Star, we need that one too. So same sort of deal. Now we're gonna take the Riemann tensor and contract it with a unit normal. So this is a special case, or yeah. So then just using the definition of the Riemann tensor. If we apply similar sort of substitutions to this one, once the dust sort of clears, we're going to get okay, so we're again using that to take covariant derivatives of this unit normal, and so instead we get derivatives of the extrinsic curvature, and then if we take this and contract C and A, then we're going to get the following. Let's call that one smiley face. I mean that one too. So these are called the Gauss-Gadacci relations. So far we have relations for basically.
So how did you get the last line there? The last line, the middle portion.
This one.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're basically gonna have to like do this substitution here, to trade off derivatives of the unit normal for
this. This has nothing to do with the star and the. Okay, so this is a new one. Okay, this is another one.
Yeah. So this just follows from the definition of the Riemann tensor, right?
Right.
And then this one follows from this, applying
yes.
tricks like that. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So far we sort of have, four gammas applied to the Riemann tensor. We have three gammas, and an n applied to the Riemann tensor. And so all we have left is we need sort of two projection operators and two unit normals applied to the Riemann tensor. Once we get to sort of three n's, three unit normals applied to the Riemann tensor, you know, by the partial asymmetry.
Sorry, how did you turn the four-dimensional derivatives, covariant derivatives, to three-dimensional there? By using that,
then using basically the, stuff like this, where you can define the three-dimensional covariant derivative by taking the four-dimensional one and projecting. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, we're not. I'm not expecting you to sort of immediately see one step to the next. There's a bit of algebra we're skipping here.
What did you say the relations are called?
They're called the Gauss-Ganacci. All right, so the one we have left is we need two spatial projections and two uninormal projections of the Riemann tensor. All right, so again, we're gonna plug in this guy. And so that's basically this double star here, but I've rewritten this acceleration term, which you can work out as actually just given by this gradient of the log of the natural log of the lapse. So if you sort of crank through some algebra there, you get that's equal to the following.
Which equation did you use for the first equation that you wrote here? Which ones did you
This one?
Yes.
I mean, this is just taking basically a definition of the Riemann tensor apply to N and then projecting it.
Awesome, but, oh.
Yeah, so again, this is just starting with the fundamentals, and then we're going to...
Yeah, so we still haven't touched these, like, we haven't combined...
Yeah, so what we're trying to do is basically work out all the different projections of the Riemann tensor.
Oh, okay.
So we worked out that one, and now we're doing this one.
Okay.
Yeah, and then we'll be done.
Can you just again remind what is the motivation that we're only looking at this specific projection?
Yeah, there are other ones, but for example, if you take three of these and then project it there, then because of the asymmetry, then we get zero. Yeah. Yeah, and then once we have all this, then we'll apply it to the Einstein equations. All right. And then if we take this one and rewrite it in terms of the lead derivative of the evolution operator M, then we get the following. And we're going to need this one too. We'll call that triangle. So far, no physics. We've just taken the Riemann tensor and calculated these various projections. But you can sort of already anticipate, okay, if I have some physics to tell me, you know, what the Riemann tensor is, then now I might get an evolution equation for the extrinsic curvature. Okay, so Einstein equations. Now let's sort of briefly talk about the projections of the stress energy tensor and just introduce some terminology there. So if we project the stress energy tensor with two unit normals, that's, you know, if we did it with some four velocities, that would be the energy density seen by that observer. So we're going to call this energy density with respect to our time slicing. If we do one spatial projection and one projection with n, that gives us the momentum density. And if we take two spatial projections, that's sometimes called the matter stress energy. The matter stress energy, or sorry, just matter stress tensor. So maybe to sort of give a little bit of intuition for these, let's consider sort of the, you know, canonical example of stress energy tensor, which would be one for a perfect fluid. So we call for a fluid, stress energy sensor, have the energy density in the fluid frame plus the pressure times UA UB, where that's the four velocity of the fluid, plus the pressure again, times the space-time metric. So if we, you know, basically take this one and do these projections, for the energy density, we'll get that. And here, you can think of this W as sort of a Lorentz factor, which is measured by this fiducial observer defined with, to be perpendicular to slices of constant time. That's the basically the Lorentz factor that that fiducial observer measures for the fluid. And when the momentum is just E plus P in the direction of, so here this is a capital UA. And so again, this is what's sometimes called the Eulerian velocity. So that's basically the velocity that's sort of intrinsic to the hypersurface. And if you want the matter tensor, it's given by that.
Sorry, the last term there, is there a row or p?
Here?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a P. That's the pressure. Okay, so now we're ready to start projecting the Einstein equations. All right, so first we're going to project the Einstein equations with an A and an B. So we're going to get the following. This turns to a plus because an A contracted with itself is minus 1. And then if we use this one, star, we can rewrite this in terms of our spatial quantities. Yeah, so this is so this is sort of, you can think of the, you know, essentially the TT component of the Einstein equations, and it's known as the Hamiltonian constraint. So you'll notice that it basically doesn't involve any second time derivatives of the metric, right? And so that's kind of why we use the word constraint. You know, we'll talk a little bit about next class, you know, how you might go about solving these constraints. You know, this one is sort of the one that would, if we take the Newtonian limit, it would reduce to the Poisson equation for the, you know, gravitational potential. This is also the one that would give you the first free one equation if we plugged in the FRW spacetime. All right, so that's one constraint. Now we're going to take the Einstein equations and project with one NA and then one spatial projection operator. So we're going to get a term like that, but of course, when we contract those two, we just get zero. And then the matter term, this gives us the momentum. And then if we use the smiley face equation right here, then we can rewrite this as the following. And this one is called the momentum constraint. And obviously, because that's the momentum on the right-hand side. And again, we use the word constraint because it doesn't involve second time derivatives of the metric or first or equivalently first time derivatives of the extrinsic curvature. Yeah, because this doesn't involve, time derivatives of the, so basically the, from the equation wrote down at the beginning of class, you can basically think of the extrinsic curvature as telling you what the first time derivative of the metric is. And so this doesn't involve time derivatives of the extrinsic curvature or equivalently second time derivatives of the metric. Yeah, so it's something that you can, it's defined solely in terms of quantities that are given by some hypersurface. So just given one hypersurface, you can check whether or not it solves the Hamiltonian constraint and the momentum constraint. All right, so, finally, project the Einstein equations with two spatial projections. Before we do that, let's, to make our lives a little bit easier, go to the trace reverse form of the Einstein equations. So just subtract out the trace. And get Einstein equations like that. And we apply two spatial projection operators. To simplify this left-hand side, we're going to use this diamond equation, and what else do we need? The triangle equation, which is where? Hopefully I haven't erased it.
Triangle's there.
All right, there you go. I'll wait there. So when we plug those two in, we get the following. And then this part is just the same as there. So basically, now we have all three-dimensional quantities, and we've arrived at our basically evolution equation for the extrinsic curvature.
Sorry, is that R cubed CD?
Well, this is the three-dimensional Ricci tensor. Yeah. Yeah, so this basically tells you if you have the extrinsic curvature on one hypersurface, you can calculate all these quantities, and you can figure out how it evolves to the next hypersurface. And like we already said, we already know how to evolve the intrinsic spatial metric, which is given by basically this equation. And that's pretty kinematical. So you'll notice that these two equations here don't involve the lapse and the shift, right? But this equation and the evolution of the spatial metric do involve that. So in order to sort of evolve forward in time, you need some additional information, and basically, we can think of this as due to the diffeomorphism invariance of the Einstein equations. Basically, we have freedom to choose coordinates, right? And the way we choose coordinates would be by specifying the lapse and the shift, or some evolution equations for those as well. So in order to carry that out, you need some extra information, basically, that sets your you can call your coordinates or your gauge.
So is this kind of the corresponding Cauchy-Dury equation?
Yeah, I think, but there where you would sort of take it with null surfaces, right? Instead of spatial surfaces, right? But yeah, I think it's something, yeah.
Sorry, you said there is, how can I say there is lapse in this?
Yeah, just like a lapse. All these alphas are lapses.
Alphas are shifts.
In this guy, basically, this M, right?
I see.
So if you wanted to rewrite things of just in terms of partial t's, you would have to expand this out, and you get some shifts as well.
Is specifying lapse and shift the same as saying that what observer I'm choosing, but how is it related to gauge? You said that it's the same as things in the gauge.
Yeah, well, so in GR we usually use gauge to correspond to the coordinate freedom. So we kind of use coordinates, space-time coordinates and gauge interchangeably. Yeah. So you might worry that in some sense we're kind of overdetermined, right? Because we can start with some extrinsic curvature and some spatial metric. And then we can use these evolution equations after using our coordinate degree of freedom to figure out what these values should be at all times just by evolving them. But we have these extra equations here that have to be satisfied at all times, right? So might be worried that, okay, how do you guarantee those will be satisfied? So in fact, the Einstein equations have this property that if you start with some basically, if on some initial hypersurface you satisfy these equations, then the evolution will guarantee that if you evolve with the Einstein equation, the evolution part of the Einstein equations, then in some later hypersurface these constraints will still be satisfied. So that's kind of analogous to the Maxwell equations, So recall for the Maxwell equations, we can basically again divide those into constraint equations. In this case, that the divergence of E is equal to the charge density and the divergence of E is equal to zero. So those are sort of our constraints. And evolution equations for E and B. So these are sort of our evolution equations. And if we basically take the time derivative of these equations, so take this one, and then use the fact that divergence of a curl is zero, then we get this. So basically, if we start out with some initial data that has no divergence of B, we evolve with this, then divergence will stay B. The divergence of B will stay zero. And you can take the time derivative of this. And we'll get that. And then if we apply charge conservation, then again, we get that if we satisfy this constraint initially, then evolve with our evolution equations, then it'll be satisfied at all times. So, we'll basically show that the Einstein equations have the same property. But one thing to note here is that if you just have some random sources that don't obey charge conservation, then you will generate magnetic monopoles or violations of this. And the same way, if you try to couple the Einstein equations to some stress energy tensor that doesn't obey conservation of stress energy, then again, you will violate the constraints. Yeah, so I think we're about out of time. So let me stop there and ask if there are any questions.
So given that we have a nice stress energy tensor, are these constraints already satisfied and evolved? Or do we need to check?
No. So basically, if you want to, where we're going is that when you specify some initial data for the Einstein equations, you have to make sure that they solve this initially. Just in the same way that you can't start with some E, like if you start with a B field that has divergence, then the Maxwell equations won't help you. They'll just keep that same divergence of B. But what the Einstein equations do tell you is that if you start with these being zero, then evolve, then they'll stay zero. But this is actually a hard problem that people spend a lot of time thinking about, is how does one construct initial data that solve the constraints for things like binary black holes and things like that. And in general, it's rather complicated because you have to solve these equations, which are usually put in a form of nonlinear elliptic equations. Yeah. Any other questions? Yep.
I don't have a well-formed question, but if you treat these constraints as like because in the Maxwell scenario, like when you try to quantize E and M, like you have like the constraints turn out to not commute, or like and on shell, or not they don't they only commute on shell. Like here, like when I say that, the constraint is always satisfied. I don't know. Is there any obstruction to say, if you want to look at the, like, is it only, I don't know, always say, like, constraint is always satisfied. It says, it's like saying they can build on shell, right? Like, whatever vector field they generate, whatever. But,
yeah, so,
I don't know. So, like, is there a way of putting it off? Like, is there a way to generalize it to say, like, okay, this is, they not only commute on shell, but they also commute in general, or like, I don't know, like, is there some sort of obstruction to quantizing the
obstruction?
To quantizing gravity?
Is that one of the simple obstructions to
That's fine. I'm not quite sure what to answer there. We're not going to talk about quantizing gravity at all. Just with regards to considering.
So you just lost your microphone. Oops.
Yeah, but maybe if I can just understand your question as it relates to like the sort of classical constraint equations, what is it exactly?
I guess even classically, like because if you were to have a Hamiltonian formulation of gravity, your constraint are like gives you surface constraint surfaces in your phase space, right? But
That was kind of the original idea of this, like. What's called the ADM or 3 plus 1 decomposition was to kind of give you a Hamiltonian formulation of gravity.
So if you say that you want your constraints to always hold, the vector field generated by the constraint must commute with the Hamiltonian, right? Is that just a condition in the constraint surface, or like
I'm not quite sure I understand your question.
Do they only commute with the Hamiltonian on the constraint surface, or like in general? Because there when we say that constraint evolution of that constraint is zero, it means that it commutes with the Hamiltonian, right? Poisson commutes with the Hamiltonian.
What Poisson commutes?
Like that constraint. Uh-huh. Because the evolution of that constraint is zero.
Yeah. But what is that? So you mean like if this constraint would correspond to some vector field?
Not just the function. Like this constraint is a function, right?
Yes. Yeah. And the function itself.
It should commute with the Hamiltonian. Poisson commutes with the Hamiltonian. But like.
Yeah, so maybe we should end class here. But yeah, we can stick around and talk about this.